Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Down and Out in Paris and London by George Orwell, narrated by Patrick Tull. This work is copyrighted 1933 by George Orwell. This recording is copyrighted 1986 by Recorded Books. While at school, Eric Blair, better known as George Orwell, read and was fascinated by The People of the Abyss, an account written in 1902 by Jack London about his life in the London slums. In the spring of 1928, Orwell copied London's experiment, first in Paris and later in London. Nearly all of the incidents described actually happened, though they've been rearranged, Orwell wrote. The truth may be closer to Orwell's comment on Dickens. He had the habit of telling small lies in order to emphasize the truth. And now, Down and Out in Paris and London.
Chapter 1. The Rue du Coq d'Or, Paris, 7 in the morning. A succession of furious, choking yells from the street. Madame Mons, who kept the little hotel opposite mine, had come out onto the pavement to address a lodger on the third floor. Her bare feet were stuck into sabots, and her grey hair was streaming down. Madame Mons.
Salope! Salope! How many times have I told you not to squash bugs on the wallpaper? Do you think you've bought the hotel, eh? Why can't you throw them out of the window like everyone else? Putain! Salope!
The woman on the third floor.
Vache!
Thereupon a whole variegated chorus of yells, as windows were flung open on every side, and half the street joined in the quarrel. They shut up abruptly 10 minutes later, when a squadron of cavalry rode past and people stopped shouting to look at them. I sketch this scene just to convey something of the spirit of the Rue du Coq d'Or. Not that quarrels were the only thing that happened there, but still we seldom got through the morning without at least one outburst of this description. Quarrels, and the desolate cries of street hawkers, and the shouts of children chasing orange peel over the cobbles, and at night, loud singing and the sour reek of the refuse carts made up the atmosphere of the street. It was a very narrow street, a ravine of tall, leprous houses lurching towards one another in queer attitudes, as though they'd all been frozen in the act of collapse. All the houses were hotels, and packed to the tiles with lodgers, mostly Poles, Arabs, and Italians. At the foot of the hotels were tiny bistros where you could be drunk for the equivalent of a shilling. On Saturday nights, about a third of the male population of the quarter was drunk. There was fighting over women, and the Arab navvies who lived in the cheapest hotels used to conduct mysterious feuds and fight them out with chairs and occasionally revolvers. At night, the policemen would only come through the street two together. It was a fairly rackety place, and yet amid the noise and dirt lived the usual respectable French shopkeepers, bakers and laundresses, and the like, keeping themselves to themselves and quietly piling up small fortunes. It was quite a representative Paris slum. My hotel was called the Hôtel des Trois Moineaux. It was a dark, rickety warren of 5 stories, cut up by wooden partitions into 40 rooms. The rooms were small and inveterately dirty, for there was no maid, and Madame F., the patron, had no time to do any sweeping. The walls were thin as matchwood, and to hide the cracks they had been covered with layer after layer of pink paper, which had come loose and housed innumerable bugs. Near the ceiling, long lines of bugs marched all day like columns of soldiers, and at night came down ravenously hungry, so that one had to get up every few hours and kill them in hecatombs. Sometimes, when the bugs got too bad, one used to burn sulphur and drive them into the next room, whereupon the lodger next door would retort by having his room sulphured and drive the bugs back. It was a dirty place, but homelike, for Madame F. and her husband were good sorts. The rent of the rooms varied between 30 and 50 francs a week. The lodgers were a floating population, largely foreigners who used to turn up without luggage, stay a week, and then disappear again. They were of every trade: cobblers, bricklayers, stonemasons, navvies, students, prostitutes, ragpickers. Some of them were fantastically poor. In one of the attics, there was a Bulgarian student who made fancy shoes for the American market. From 6 to 12, he sat on his bed, making a dozen pairs of shoes and earning 35 francs. The rest of the day, he attended lectures at the Sorbonne. He was studying for the church, and books of theology lay face down on his leather-strewn floor. In another room lived a Russian woman and her son, who called himself an artist. The mother worked 16 hours a day, darning socks at 25 centimes a sock, while the son, decently dressed, loafed in the Montparnasse cafes. One room was let to two different lodgers, one a day worker and the other a night worker. In another room, a widower shared the same bed with his two grown-up daughters, both consumptive. There were eccentric characters in the hotel. The Paris slums are a gathering place for eccentric people, people who have fallen into solitary, half-mad grooves of life and given up trying to be normal or decent. Poverty frees them from ordinary standards of behaviour, just as money frees people from work. Some of the lodgers in our hotel lived lives that were curious beyond words. There were the Rougier, for instance, an old, ragged, dwarfish couple who plied an extraordinary trade. They used to sell postcards on the Boulevard Saint-Michel. The curious thing was that the postcards were sold in sealed packets as pornographic ones, but were actually photographs of Chateau on the Loire. The buyers did not discover this till too late, and of course never complained. The Rougier earned about 100 francs a week, and by strict economy managed to be always half-starved and half-drunk. The filth of their room was such that one could smell it on the floor below. According to Madame F., neither of the Rougier had taken off their clothes for 4 years. Or there was Henri, who worked in the sewers. He was a tall, melancholy man with curly hair, rather romantic-looking in his long sewer-man's boots. Henri's peculiarity was that he did not speak, except for the purposes of work, literally for days together. Only a year before, he had been a chauffeur in good employ and saving money. One day he fell in love, and when the girl refused him, he lost his temper and kicked her. On being kicked, the girl fell desperately in love with Henri, and for a fortnight they lived together and spent 1,000 francs of Henri's money. Then the girl was unfaithful. Henri planted a knife in her upper arm and was sent to prison for 6 months. As soon as she had been stabbed, the girl fell more in love with Henri than ever, and the two made up their quarrel and agreed that when Henri came out of jail, he should buy a taxi and they would marry and settle down. But a fortnight later, the girl was unfaithful again, and when Henri came out, she was with child. Henri did not stab her again. He drew out all his savings and went on a drinking bout that ended in another month's imprisonment. After that, he went to work in the sewers. Nothing would induce Henri to talk. If you asked him why he worked in the sewers, he never answered, but simply crossed his wrists to signify handcuffs and jerked his head southward towards the prison. Bad luck seemed to have turned him half-witted in a single day. Or there was R., an Englishman, who lived 6 months of the year in Putney with his parents and 6 months in France. During his time in France, he drank 4 litres of wine a day and 6 litres on Saturdays. He had once travelled as far as the Azores because the wine there is cheaper than anywhere in Europe. He was a gentle, domesticated creature, never rowdy or quarrelsome, and never sober. He would lie in bed till midday, and from then till midnight he was in his corner of the bistro, quietly and methodically soaking. While he soaked, he talked, in a refined, womanish voice, about antique furniture. Except myself, R was the only Englishman in the quarter. There were plenty of other people who lived lives just as eccentric as these. Monsieur Jules, the Romanian, who had a glass eye and wouldn't admit it. Firex, the Limousin stonemason. Roucol, the miser. He died before my time, though. Old Laurent, the rag merchant, who used to copy his signature from a slip of paper he carried in his pocket. It would be fun to write some of their biographies if one had time. I'm trying to describe the people in our quarter, not for the mere curiosity, but because they're all part of the story. Poverty is what I'm writing about, and I had my first contact with poverty in this slum. The slum, with its dirt and its queer lives, was first an object lesson in poverty, and then the background of my own experiences. It is for that reason that I try to give some idea of what life was like there. Chapter 2. Life in the Quarter. Our bistro, for instance, at the foot of the Hôtel des Trois Moineaux. A tiny brick-floored room, half underground, with wine-sodden tables, and a photograph of a funeral inscribed Crédit est mort, and red-sashed workmen carving sausage with big jackknives, and Madame F., a splendid Auvergnat peasant woman, with the face of a strong-minded cow, drinking Malaga all day for her stomach, and games of dice for apéritif, and songs about les fraises et les framboises, and about Madelon, who said, Comment épouser un soldat, moi qui aime tout le régiment? And extraordinarily public love-making. Half the hotel used to meet in the bistro in the evenings. I wish one could find a pub in London a quarter as cheery. One heard queer conversations in the bistro. As a sample, I give you Charlie, one of the local curiosities, talking. Charlie was a youth of family and education who had run away from home and lived on occasional remittances. Picture him very pink and young, with the fresh cheeks and soft brown hair of a nice little boy, and lips excessively red and wet like cherries. His feet are tiny, his arms abnormally short, his hands dimpled like a baby's. He has a way of dancing and capering while he talks, as though he were too happy and too full of life to keep still for an instant. It is 3 in the afternoon, and there is no one in the bistro except Madame F., and one or two men who are out of work, but it is all the same to Charlie whom he talks to, so long as he can talk about himself. He declaims like an orator on a barricade, rolling the words on his tongue and gesticulating with his short arms. His small, rather piggy eyes glitter with enthusiasm. He is, somehow, profoundly disgusting to see. He is talking of love, his favourite subject. Ah, l'amour, l'amour! Ah, que les femmes m'ont tué! Alas, messieurs et dames, women have been my ruin, beyond all hope my ruin. At 22 I am utterly worn out and finished, but what things I have learned! What abysses of wisdom have I not plumbed! How great a thing it is to have acquired the true wisdom, to have become, in the highest sense of the word, a civilized man, to have become raffiné, vicieux, etc., etc. Messieurs et dames, I perceive that you are sad. Ah, mais la vie est belle, you must not be sad. Be more gay, I beseech you. Fill high the bowl with Samian wine. We will not sink of seams like these. Ah, que la vie est belle. Listen, messieurs et dames, out of the fullness of my experience, I will discourse to you of love. I will explain to you what is the true meaning of love, what is the true sensibility, the higher, more refined pleasure, which is known to civilized men alone. I will tell you of the happiest day of my life. Alas, but I am past the time when I could know such happiness as that. It is gone for ever. The very possibility, even the desire for it, are gone. Listen, then. It was 2 years ago. My brother was in Paris. He is a lawyer, and my parents had told him to find me and take me out to dinner. We hate each other, my brother and I, but we preferred not to disobey my parents. We dined, and at dinner he grew very drunk upon 3 bottles of Bordeaux. I took him back to his hotel, and on the way I bought a bottle of brandy, and when we had arrived I made my brother drink a tumblerful of it. I told him it was something to make him sober. He drank it, and immediately he fell down like somebody in a fit, dead drunk. I lifted him up and propped his back against the bed. Then I went through his pockets. I found 1,100 francs, and with that I hurried down the stairs, jumped into a taxi, and escaped. My brother did not know my address. I was safe. Where does a man go when he has money? To the bordel, naturally. But you do not suppose that I was going to waste my time on some vulgar debauchery fit only for navvies. Confound it, one is a civilized man. I was fastidious, exigent, you understand, with 1,000 francs in my pocket. It was midnight before I found what I was looking for. I had fallen in with a very smart youth of 18, dressed en smoking and with his hair cut à l'américaine. And we were talking in a quiet bistro away from the boulevards. We understood one another well, that youth and I. We talked of this and that, and discussed ways of diverting oneself. Presently, we took a taxi together and were driven away. The taxi stopped in a narrow, solitary street with a single gas lamp flaring at the end. There were dark puddles among the stones. Down one side ran the high, blank wall of a convent. My guide led me to a tall, ruinous house with shuttered windows and knocked several times at the door. Presently, there was a sound of footsteps and a shooting of bolts, and the door opened a little. A hand came round the edge of it. It was a large, crooked hand that held itself palm upwards under our noses, demanding money. My guide put his foot between the door and the step. "How much do you want?" he said. 1,000 francs, said a woman's voice. "Pay up at once or you don't come in." I put 1,000 francs into the hand and gave the remaining 100 to my guide. He said good night and left me. I could hear the voice inside counting the notes, and then a thin old crow of a woman in a black dress put her nose out and regarded me suspiciously before letting me in. It was very dark inside. I could see nothing except a flaring gas jet that illuminated a patch of plaster wall, throwing everything else into deeper shadow. There was a smell of rats and dust. Without speaking, the old woman lighted a candle at the gas jet, then hobbled in front of me down a stone passage to the top of a flight of stone steps. "Voila," she said. "Go down into the cellar there and do what you like. I shall see nothing, hear nothing, know nothing. You are free, you understand, perfectly free. Ah, monsieur, need I describe to you? Forcément, you know it yourselves, that shiver, half of terror and half of joy, that goes through one at these moments." I crept down, feeling my way. I could hear my breathing and the scraping of my shoes on the stones. Otherwise, all was silence. At the bottom of the stairs, my hand met an electric switch. I turned it, and a great electrolier of 12 red globes flooded the cellar with a red light. And behold, I was not in a cellar, but in a bedroom. A great, rich, garish bedroom, coloured blood-red from top to bottom. Figure it to yourselves, messieurs et dames. Red carpet on the floor, red paper on the walls, red plush on the chairs, even the ceiling red. Everywhere red, burning into the eyes. It was a heavy, stifling red, as though the light were shining through bowls of blood. At the far end stood a huge square bed with quilts red like the rest, and on it a girl was lying, dressed in a frock of red velvet. At the sight of me, she shrank away and tried to hide her knees under the short dress. I had halted by the door. "Come here, my chicken," I called to her. She gave a whimper of fright. With a bound, I was beside the bed. She tried to elude me, but I seized her by the throat. Like this, do you see? Tight. She struggled. She began to cry out for mercy, but I held her fast, forcing back her head and staring down into her face. She was 20 years old, perhaps. Her face was the broad, dull face of a stupid child, but it was coated with paint and powder, and her blue, stupid eyes, shining in the red light, wore that shocked, distorted look that one sees nowhere save in the eyes of these women. She was some peasant girl, doubtless, whom her parents had sold into slavery. Without another word, I pulled her off the bed and threw her onto the floor, and then I fell upon her like a tiger. Ah, the joy, the incomparable rapture of that time! There, messieurs et dames, is what I would expound to you. Voilà l'amour! There is the true love. There is the only thing in the world worth striving for. There is the thing beside which all your arts and ideals, all your philosophies and creeds, all your fine words and high attitudes are as pale and profitless as ashes. When one has experienced love, the true love, what is there in the world that seems more than a mere ghost of joy? More and more savagely I renewed the attack. Again and again the girl tried to escape. She cried out for mercy anew, but I laughed at her. "Mercy," I said. "Do you suppose I have come here to show mercy? Do you suppose I have paid 1,000 francs for that? I swear to you, messieurs et dames, that if it were not for that accursed law that robs us of our liberty, I would have murdered her at that moment." Ah, how she screamed! With what
bitter cries of agony, but there was no one to hear them. Down there under the streets of Paris, we were as secure as at the heart of a pyramid. Tears streamed down the girl's face, washing away the powder in long, dirty smears. Ah, that irrecoverable time! You, Monsieur Redam, you who have not cultivated the finer sensibilities of love, for you such pleasure is almost beyond conception. And I, too, now that my youth is gone, ah, youth, shall never again see life so beautiful as that. It is finished. Ah, yes, it is gone. Gone forever. Ah, the poverty, the shortness, the disappointment of human joy. For in reality, car en réalité, what is the duration of the supreme moment of love? It is nothing. An instant. A second, perhaps. A second of ecstasy, and after that, dust, ashes, nothingness. And so just for one instant, I captured the supreme happiness, the highest and most refined emotion to which human beings can attain, and in the same moment it was finished, and I was left to what? All my savagery, my passion, were scattered like the petals of a rose. I was left cold and languid, full of vain regrets. In my revulsion, I even felt a kind of pity for the weeping girl on the floor. Is it not nauseous that we should be the prey of such mean emotions? I didn't look at the girl again. My sole thought was to get away. I hastened up the steps of the vault and out into the street. It was dark and bitterly cold. The streets were empty. The stones echoed under my heels with a hollow, lonely ring. All my money was gone. I had not even the price of a taxi fare. I walked back alone to my cold, solitary room. But there, messieurs dames, that is what I promised to expound to you. That is love. That was the happiest day of my life. He was a curious specimen, Charlie. I describe him just to show what diverse characters could be found flourishing in the Coq d'Or quarter. Chapter 3. I lived in the Coq d'Or quarter for about a year and a half. One day in summer I found that I had just 450 francs left, and beyond this nothing but 36 francs a week, which I earned by giving English lessons. Hitherto I hadn't thought about the future, but I now realised that I must do something at once. I decided to start looking for a job, and, very luckily as it turned out, I took the precaution of paying 200 francs for a month's rent in advance. With the other 250 francs, besides the English lessons, I could live a month. And in a month I should probably find work. I aimed at becoming a guide to one of the tourist companies, or perhaps an interpreter. However, a piece of bad luck prevented this. One day, there turned up at the hotel a young Italian who called himself a compositor. He was rather an ambiguous person, for he wore side whiskers, which are the mark either of an apache or an intellectual, and nobody was quite certain in which class to put him. Madame F. did not like the look of him, and made him pay a week's rent in advance. The Italian paid the rent, and stayed 6 nights at the hotel. During this time he managed to prepare some duplicate keys, and on the last night he robbed a dozen rooms, including mine. Luckily he did not find the money that was in my pockets, so I was not left penniless. I was left with just 47 francs. That is 7 and 10 pence. This put an end to my plans of looking for work. I had now got to live at the rate of about 6 francs a day, and from the start it was too difficult to leave much thought for anything else. It was now that my experiences of poverty began. For 6 francs a day, if not actual poverty, is on the fringe of it. 6 francs is a shilling. And you can live on a shilling a day in Paris if you know how, but it's a complicated business. It's altogether curious, your first contact with poverty. You've thought so much about poverty. It's the thing you feared all your life, the thing you knew would happen to you sooner or later. And it is all so utterly and prosaically different. You thought it would be quite simple.
It is extraordinarily complicated. You thought it would be terrible. It is merely squalid and boring. It's the peculiar lowness of poverty that you discover first. The shifts that it puts you to. The complicated meanness. The crust wiping. You discover, for instance, the secrecy attaching to poverty. At a sudden stroke, you have been reduced to an income of 6 francs a day. But, of course, you dare not admit it. You have got to pretend that you are living quite as usual. From the start, it tangles you in a net of lies. And even with the lies, you can hardly manage it. You stop sending clothes to the laundry, and the laundress catches you in the street and asks you why. You mumble something, and she, thinking you're sending the clothes elsewhere, is your enemy for life. The tobacconist keeps asking you why you've cut down your smoking. There are letters you want to answer and cannot because stamps are too expensive. And then there are your meals. Meals are the worst difficulty of all. Every day at mealtimes you go out, ostensibly to a restaurant, and loaf an hour in the Luxembourg Gardens watching the pigeons. Afterwards, you smuggle your food home in your pockets. Your food is bread and margarine, or bread and wine. And even the nature of the food is governed by lies. You have to buy rye bread instead of household bread because the rye loaves, though dearer, are round and can be smuggled in your pockets. This wastes you a franc a day. Sometimes, to keep up appearances, you have to spend 60 centimes on a drink and go correspondingly short of food. Your linen gets filthy and you run out of soap and razor blades. Your hair wants cutting, and you try to cut it yourself, with such fearful results that you have to go to the barber after all and spend the equivalent of a day's food. All day you are telling lies, and expensive lies. You discover the extreme precariousness of your 6 francs a day. Mean disasters happen and rob you of food. You have spent your last 80 centimes on half a litre of milk and are boiling it over the spirit lamp. While it boils, a bug runs down your forearm. You give the bug a flick with your nail and it falls plop straight into the milk. There is nothing for it but to throw the milk away and go foodless. You go to the baker's to buy a pound of bread, and you wait while the girl cuts a pound for another customer. She's clumsy and cuts more than a pound. "Pardon, monsieur," she says, "I suppose you don't mind paying 2 sous extra." Bread is a franc a pound, and you have exactly a franc. When you think that you too might be asked to pay 2 sous extra and would have to confess that you could not, you bolt in panic. It's hours before you dare venture into a baker's shop again. You go to the greengrocer's to spend a franc on a kilogram of potatoes, but one of the pieces that make up the franc is a Belgian piece, and the shopman refuses it. You slink out of the shop and can never go there again. You've strayed into a respectable quarter and you see a prosperous friend coming. To avoid him, you dodge into the nearest café. Once in the café, you must buy something, so you spend your last 50 centimes on a glass of black coffee with a dead fly in it. One could multiply these disasters by the hundred. They're part of the process of being hard up. You discover what it is like to be hungry. With bread and margarine in your belly, you go out and look into the shop windows. Everywhere there is food, insulting you in huge, wasteful piles. Whole dead pigs, baskets of hot loaves, great yellow blocks of butter, strings of sausages, mountains of potatoes, vast Gruyere cheeses like grindstones. A snivelling self-pity comes over you at the sight of so much food. You plan to grab a loaf and run, swallowing it before they catch you. And you refrain from pure funk. You discover the boredom which is inseparable from poverty, the times when you have nothing to do, and being underfed can interest yourself in nothing. For half a day at a time you lie on your bed, feeling like the jeune squelette in Baudelaire's poem. Only food could rouse you. You discover that a man who has gone even a week on bread and margarine is not a man any longer, only a belly with a few accessory organs. This, one could describe it further, but it's all in the same style, is life on 6 francs a day. Thousands of people in Paris live it, struggling artists and students, prostitutes when their luck is out. Out of work, people of all kinds. It is the suburbs, as it were, of poverty. I continued in this style for about 3 weeks. The 47 francs were soon gone, and I had to do what I could on 36 francs a week from the English lessons.